My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonatotum, episode 91. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonatotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and staying sane in the process. Who am I to be talking to you about such things? Well, I've been an independent creator since the turn of the century. I was one of the first podcasters. I was in the first wave of the digital independent publishing movement back in 2005. And I continue to be an author and obviously podcaster. And my day job is helping other authors, writers, musicians, artists, and other creators bring their creative endeavors to fruition, to market, and to an audience. Every other week, we do one of these episodes of Sonatotum, and we feature a conversation, an evergreen talk with an author, usually an author, poet, playwright, sometimes all three, in the hopes of exposing their own thoughts on making stuff and finding success and staying healthy and sane, in the hopes that you will find some value in that. Before we get into talking about today's guest, I want to mention that I'm recording this on Wednesday, July 26th, 2023, from the lush and lavish studios of MWS Media in Huntington Beach, California. Today, I learned, along with the rest of the world, that we lost the artist known as Sinead O'Connor. And you know, the details are not yet forthcoming. Doesn't matter, really, how she left us. It's just, as it always happens, when someone who has been important to me as a creator leaves the world, it's got me down. It's got me thinking. It's got me sad. That's the simplest word for it, right? Just sad. Sinead O'Connor was 56 years old, just a few months, maybe 7 months, 8 months older than me. I just had my 56th birthday, not even 2 weeks ago. And so that's even crazier for me to think about when people who have had such a huge impact on culture, and they're the same age as me or younger, and they're gone all of a sudden. And I was trying to find the words for it earlier today as I was running some errands. The closest I can think of it is that when someone my age, who I've grown up with and who's been so powerful a creator, leaves the world, having done so much more than I have done at that same age or by that same age, it makes me feel that every day that goes by that I'm not prioritizing my own creativity is some sort of betrayal to my own potential. It's a flaunting of my own mortality. And it bums me out, I'm not going to lie. It's been a pretty hectic, 4 months. These past four, 5 months of this year. And I have not had a whole lot of time to create, as regular listeners to the show will know. And it I don't know. I don't want to make the whole show about it. I want to make the whole show about our guest. But I wanted to note that that is what happened today. And that's what's on my mind today. Sinead O'Connor is gone. She was an incredible artist. And check out her whole catalog if you're not familiar with her. Maybe you're young. Maybe you never got into it. Maybe the only song you know is her cover of the Prince song, Nothing Compares to You. That's a blip on her creative radar. From that same album, I Do Not Want What I Have Not Got. I think that's the title. Check out The Emperor's New Clothes. Check out Three Babies. Check out This Is the Last Day of Our Acquaintance. She was a hell of a songwriter and a champion of children's rights and the rights of the abused and of her own convictions. I'm not too happy that we live in a world that we don't share with Sinead O'Connor anymore. But I'm happy that we have her work and her inspiration. I will say that I've found moments in the last week or so, at least since I've spoken to you about 2 weeks ago, since the Exhauster Mission episode, I will say that I've had a few hours here or there over the last 2 weeks where I've done what I'm going to say is washing my brushes, you know? I'm doing a lot of preparatory work. And no, it's not writing. It's not making, but it's putting me in that place. It's kind of like when you've come back home after a long trip away and you walk through the door and you just kind of take in the scent of the place where you live. You ever experienced that? There's a particular smell to the place that you live where you haven't been when you haven't been there for a while. And it's just like, I'm home. Well, I feel like I'm kind of standing just inside the door of the house of my truth, of my soul, of my actual true self, which is how I feel when I'm making things. And it's pretty much the only time I feel that way. So I have been almost defiantly carving out moments to do that, to clean those brushes, to prepare the space in my heart to get back to work. And yeah, it's going to be a busy month. We're here at the end of July 2023. August is going to be nuts. And the first 2 weeks of September are going to be nuts, at least. But I'll do my best. On today's episode of Sonatotum with Matthew Wayne Selznick, Sonatotum episode 91, my guest is Teresa Wilhelm Waldoff. She is the world's leading expert on the Ames Project section of the Manhattan Project. She's an independent scholar, and her in-depth research has resulted in the first ever account of the life of chemist Harley Wilhelm, who was a critical member of the Manhattan Project, especially considering work that he did on the Iowa State campus during the Manhattan Project. Harley Wilhelm just also happens to be Teresa Wilhelm Waldoff's grandfather. So this project, Wilhelm's Way, was not only Teresa's first book, it's a real labor of love and just the beginning of Teresa's writing career. I think you will get a lot out of this conversation. Another different perspective from the creative writing life. And you can find all the show notes for my conversation with Teresa Wilhelm Waldoff over there at mattselznick.com/sonatotum-091. And that's, of course, Matt, M-A-T-T, Selznick, S-E-L-Z-N-I-C-K.com/sonitotum, S-O-N-I-T-O-T-U-M, -091. That's also where you can leave a comment if you'd like to share your feedback about this episode, and where you can find all the ways to subscribe to the show for free, or to become a patron, or to perhaps engage in my services, or purchase one of my books, novels, short stories, audiobooks. MattSelznick.com. All right. Here is my conversation with Teresa Wilhelm Waldoff. So I always like to start these shows by asking sort of a fundamental question, and that is, what do you create?
I create art, which is interesting because until about 2 weeks ago, I didn't realize that. Writing a nonfiction book, which was my first venture into writing a book, I never thought of it as art because it's very factual. But as I wrote the book, I wanted it to be read more like a novel because I wanted people to turn the page and keep turning the page. And this particular piece that I wrote has a combination of science, history, and a life story. And when I got affirmation when I won this Minnesota Book Award, you know, maybe I am an artist. And another reason I thought that is because a few years ago, I was called upon to save the Civic Theater from going into bankruptcy. So I kind of like got into art in the theater world. And when I was growing up, I was a musician. I played the trumpet. I was a very good trumpeter back in the day. In fact, my high school won the National High School Concert Band Contest way, way back decades ago. And I also grew up taking dance lessons. I took dance lessons for 12 years. So I was ballet, acrobatics, baton, toe, and jazz. So I think about myself, I never thought of myself as an artist until I kind of got this big confirmation a couple of weeks ago. And now I'm working on novels. So my first book was this nonfiction piece, this true story, but now I'm working on novels. So I create art, I guess.
Well, congratulations on the award. That's always lovely to be recognized. I'm curious because, yeah, clearly as a child, as a teen, you were involved in artistic pursuits and stuck with them, it sounds like, for some time, 12 years of dance, assuming your parents weren't monsters and you wanted to do that. So what pulled you away from that creative urge, from that creative expression?
That's an interesting question because my dad was an engineer, very practical, right? And his father was a scientist. Very practical, and you make a living doing practical things, not being an art. And so when I went off to college, I didn't even go out for band in college, and I stopped playing the trumpet. And I was started out as an accounting major, then I changed it to a business major, and eventually I ended up with a speech communications or liberal arts major, but I ended up in sales. So I never really thought of myself that I could make a living doing that. So I never considered it. And as far as writing goes, that was the furthest thing from my head. I mean, I did fine on my papers in college, but I didn't ever get any kudos for it. And then when I decided to go back and get my MBA, and here I was in my 50s going back to college, and I hadn't been in school for over 30 years, and now I'm going to go back and get my MBA. And I thought, I haven't written a paper for decades. I better take a writing class. So I took a writing class at a vocational school, and the instructor asked for permission to use one of my papers for an example for future classes of how to do it. I'm like, well, that's interesting. Then the next paper, he told me I should get it published. And it was a different kind of paper. We were writing different kinds of papers. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, maybe I have a skill set I never thought that I had. And I actually asked him about that. And he said, well, you can tell that you read a lot by the way that you write. And I did read a lot. I was in my career in sales. I was always traveling. And so I always had a book with me and was always reading, waiting for airplanes and reading on airplanes. And so I read a lot. And I guess that must have helped me to be able to formulate words and sentences and paragraphs that I hadn't realized, I was learning as I was reading.
It's interesting that your dad was an engineer, your grandfather was a scientist. I immediately think of those as both being very creative pursuits, but I understand that generationally they haven't always been considered such. You know, you have to have a creative mind to do science, to hypothesize, to know what answers you're looking for to ask the questions, you know,
right, to imagine, exactly.
To imagine, right? And the same thing with engineering. Engineering is literally figuring out tangible solutions for things that may start completely intangible. You know, again, a question to be solved.
Yes, absolutely.
And so is your dad still with us?
He just died on February 1st. Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. Well, did he come to see the benefit, the advantage, the value to the creative path you were headed down later in life?
Well, I'm not sure, because I'll tell you, my book was published in January of 2022. And in November, I was going through proofreading, and he's like, I'll believe it when I see it. So, and like, I'm in proofreading, Father. It is going to be published. You've been saying that for a decade, you know? So he had read the draft, and I made sure he had a chance to read the draft, because I didn't know if he was going to live long enough. And that just sounds so horrible, but it's true.
Well, sure.
My driving forces was trying to make sure I got the book done before he passed away. And actually, in the last 6 months, both of my parents passed away. So they both got to read the book, though. And unfortunately, they didn't, you know, see me win the award, although my father did get told that I was a finalist. So.
Yeah.
But he was very skeptical, but he read the draft and he really liked it. And of course, because it's about his dad,
right,
he was able to make sure I had everything correct. And some of the engineering things, like I'm not an engineer and I'm not a chemist. And I was writing about chemistry and all this problem solving stuff. And I had in there a 15 kilowatt or 15 watt furnace, and it was supposed to be like 15,000. You know, furnace, you know, and he's like, you got to fix that for, you know, every time he saw me, you got to fix that. And I got it fixed before. So
it's good that you had your own in-house technical advisor.
So, I did. Yeah. Yes. And my husband's an engineer as well, which I swore I would never marry an engineer, given that my father was an engineer and I didn't think I liked him. I fell in love with an engineer, and I learned to really love and appreciate the way my father thinks. And it turns out I'm actually should have been a chemist or an engineer, because I am a problem solver. Mm. In my career path in business, I ended up being a problem solver, you know, saving organizations and companies and teams, turning them around and, you know, fixing things. So I could have taken that path, and I would have gotten an earlier start being an engineer or a chemist early on. But girls, back when I was growing up, which was, you know, in the 70s,
sure,
they just weren't doing that. So, right. So anyway, that's where I ended up being in sales and marketing, and then eventually got into all this problem solving stuff.
Everything that you're talking about, though, sales and marketing especially, is at its heart, and you know this as a liberal arts major, at its heart, it's all communication.
Yes.
Marketing is just convincing. You know, convincing people that there is a value to something that will not even an objective value, but a subjective value to the person that you're trying to convince, you know, and that's.
Or solving a problem that they may not even know they have.
Right. And that's writing as well. Writing, yes. Fiction or nonfiction is just. With fiction, it's presenting problems and, you know,
yes.
Between characters or whatever, creating conflict and situations for conflict and devising how to solve those. It's all, I mean, I refer to fiction writing as much architecture than as something more, you know, sort of wishy-washy. It's, you are building something. You are being presented with problems, whether you're devising them for your characters or even just trying to work out how to best present an idea or a concept or an argument, and then solving them, you know, working down the flow chart.
Right. And you have to have a good foundation or it all caves in.
That's right. Well, what about your mom's influence on both those early artistic endeavors and what you came to later in life?
Yeah, definitely. She's the one who made sure we had dancing lessons. And no, I did not want to go to dancing lessons, but mainly because my dance instructor was not a very nice person. But it was interesting. Went for, you know, a decade, all these years of going to dance lessons and doing the recitals and everything. And then at one point, my mother finally, I was going into my senior year in high school, and my mother finally decided that my younger sister, who was a year younger than I, could quit because the instructor was saying things to her that were not nice, and gave me the option to quit. And I opted to continue, which kind of shocked her because I'd never really liked going, but then it was my choice to be there, really. Right. And then I really kind of flourished in it, but didn't continue on after I graduated from high school. But she was very artistic herself. I mean, we've been clearing out my parents' house the past couple of months, and there's just, her artwork is everywhere. I mean, she did toll painting, she sewed, she gardened, she cooked. I mean, both, you know, very creative in that. She did the decorating of the house. She just, everywhere you look, there are things that were artistic that she was doing. You know, she was influencing me, you know, just by example. I wasn't doing those things. But although there is this one thing I've got that I did when I was probably in third or fourth grade, and I had a box of crayons, and I decided to make a picture. But what I did is I took a candle and I lit it, and I took a drip at a time and created this picture. And it was a house with a yard and trees and clouds. And it was really, you know, childish kind of thing, but it took hours upon hours, which was one of the things about me that has rung true, is like, once I'm into something, I'm like a dog with a bone. I just go and I do it, and I keep doing it until it's done. So drip by drip, I created this picture. It's like an 8.5 by 11 picture, maybe a little bit bigger.
First of all, that childhood freedom of, you know, making things just for the sheer joy and curiosity of making something, you know, yeah, I could have used these crayons, but this sounds like an interesting idea, you know.
My sister wonders why my mother let me play with fire for hours on like that.
Well, because your mother knew, she saw a kindred spirit. And she wanted, I'm going to wager that she wanted to make sure that there was a little bit of balance from the other side, you know?
Yes. I would venture to say that you are correct on that.
We talked about the osmosis writing workshop that you did over the years, just being a voracious reader. How did you trend? Fiction, nonfiction, a mix, just chasing interests and passions? Tell me a little bit about that.
It was just fiction, and I would just be in the airport bookstore and just like look around and just grab one. I'd look at the back and grab one, and it wasn't any particular genre, although it was never really sci-fi or fantasy. You know, it might be a romance or a mystery thriller, or those things having to do with the government conspiracies and things like that. But there was never really any set genre that I was going for. I didn't start reading nonfiction until a bit later. I think actually not until my 40s, really, I started to read nonfiction. I really enjoy nonfiction now, and I hardly ever read fiction, which is strange, because it was like a flip-flop.
That's interesting. And now you are, after this first book, this nonfiction book about your grandfather, now you say you're starting to think about novels.
Yes, actually, you know, it's kind of neat. I've got an idea for a nonfiction that I can talk about, but I also this fiction idea is thriller, and I just did storyboarded out 5 books over the weekend. And what's interesting, though, is my husband kind of is the one who said, you should do this. And even before these two, I'd started working on a nonfiction kind of business improvement book, because that's my expertise, right? How can I solve problems? And so I started writing that. Well, I probably about 5 or 6 chapters into that, and he's like, you know, you're not going to be happy writing that book, because I retired on April 30th of this year.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And on May 2nd, I won the award. And then I started doing my story, but I'd already started writing this book about business. And he goes, you're not going to be happy writing that because you're going to be thinking about everything you hated and everything that went wrong when you were working. So do something that's going to give you joy. And so I'm like, oh, I'll write a nonfiction about something having to do with nuclear, you know, the things that came out of the Manhattan Project that were positive, mm-hmm. because there's so much negative thought about it, especially with newer generations. But we have nuclear medicine, we have nuclear energy, we have agriculture tracers, even the space program that all ties back to science that came out of the Manhattan Project. So I'm like, absolutely. I got a book that I'm going to write about that. But these novels sound really fun to do. So my husband, he and I actually sat down together, and he doesn't want to be involved in terms of having his name on anything. But he gave me a bunch of ideas, and then we started talking about characters, and we actually storyboarded out 5 books over the weekend, which is exciting.
Yeah, and quite an endeavor. I'm assuming those were some pretty long days.
Actually, we did it in a couple hours.
Okay, so I want to know then, let's get a little bit into method. How did you do this?
Well, he had the idea to begin with, and he goes, here's the character name. And he said, you know, she solves problems. She's an author. Okay, I can relate to these, right? But it's not me. And we just started talking about, well, what if this happened? And what if that happened? And bouncing it off of each other. And I was writing up post-it notes and sticking them on a board as we went. And some of them were in order, but some of them weren't. And I'm like, oh, I have to go back and really organize this. I mean, it is very much in the very initial stages. Mm. And we didn't do character development as much as main storyline, although we do have some critical pieces about the characters, the 2 primary characters in the first 3 books kind of defined. But there's a lot of things that have to happen to layer in the story and the backstories and, you know, the relationships and the protagonists and antagonists and all these things that haven't been figured out yet. But the basic story arc is figured out.
Gotcha. Okay. So you worked out the story arc for the full 5 book series. Right. You didn't right. storyboard 5 books.
No, gotcha. Just the basic okay. storyboard, the front storyboard, not all the storyboards behind it.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Gotcha. You worked out the arc, the overarching arc, as it were.
Yes.
Gotcha. Yeah. The 5 acts to the larger story.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that I can buy is happening in a couple of hours. Gotcha.
Yes. Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about what inspired you to dive into. I mean, you said you're like a dog with a bone when you get your teeth into something. What sent you down the path to get into the first book, Wilhelm's Way, which, you know, as you mentioned, is a nonfiction book and won this Minnesota Book Award in May of this year. There's one thing to be like, okay, you know, I had this grandfather whose story I've heard all my life. What inspired you to dedicate the time and the energy and the resources to actually having it become your first book?
Well, I will say this, that if I had known what I was getting myself into, I don't think it would have happened. So right. I ignorance was bliss, definitely, with this project, because it took a decade.
Once again, if you had known that it wasn't okay to make a painting with candle wax, you might not have done
yes.
it.
Yes. Exactly. So I was inspired back in my 20s, actually, in 19, I think it was 86, it was either 85 or 86 when Wilhelm Hall was named at Iowa State University. And my grandfather and my mother and father said, you need to come to Iowa for this event. They're naming a building after your grandpa. And I really
deal.
Did.
Yeah.
And I got there and the newspaper was there, the TV were there, the governor, you know, all these important people from Washington, D.C. And it just, there was one thing that was said during the event that always stuck with me. And it was Louis Ionello. And he said, if it weren't for Hardly Wilhelm, we'd all be speaking Japanese right now. Well, that's an overstatement, because we probably would have still won the war if we didn't invade Japan. But, you know, we would have won the war. A lot more people would have died, but we didn't have to invade Japan because the war ended. And so it was no overstatement, but his point was that, you know, it, because of what Wilhelm accomplished, it enabled us to end the war quickly and swiftly. And that statement always stuck with me for 30 years. I mean, my grandfather died in 95. Here it is, you know, 2015, 2012, I start working on this book and he's been long dead, but I kept hearing my father and my aunts say, well, you know, your grandpa did this and your grandpa did that. And I'm like, really? And it was just so interesting and inspiring. And then when I started working on the book and interviewing colleagues, former colleagues who are still alive and whom were all in their 90s by then, because he was 95 when he died back in 1995, and all these people were younger than him, but they were all long retired. They also were so inspired by him, and he was so highly revered, which really, you know, struck me. Mm-hmm. But as I did the research, and I would find these little nuggets, and it just kept me going. Like one day I uncovered this story in a 1914 newspaper about him playing basketball and how he scored all these points and he was a phenom. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, he's being written as a teenager. And then, you know, my parents had always, or my aunts had always said that he had solved this problem with regard to the children's teeth in Ankeny, Iowa, all turning brown. But there was nothing documenting that. So I dug around and dug around. I finally came across the study that was done and was published where he solved the problem was that the wells, they dug new wells in Ankeny and it had an overabundance of fluoride in it. So a little bit of fluoride is good for your teeth, but too much of it turns it brown. And he's the one that figured that out. And I just kept uncovering these little nuggets. It's just like, this is so interesting. And I knew he'd almost died from the Spanish influenza during World War I. And he didn't have to go to war, but he didn't die from the flu. And all these things just kept me going as I would find more things. But it was tough because I didn't really know what I was doing. I would spend a lot of time in front of the computer screen crying. I don't know.
Welcome to being a writer.
Yes. And I had to figure out, how do I take this science and make it readable to the average person? First of all, I'm not a chemist. I had one chemistry class in high school, and I'm reading these original documents from the 1940s that are probably still radioactive because they were around all the uranium and stuff. And I'm reading these documents and it's all in chemical terms. So I'm looking up all these words and trying to discern, okay, what in these documents is important for this story? Because right. There were so many of them. And I, you know, it took a long time for me to distill it down to the key things I thought needed to be in the story. Once I distilled it down, then I had to convert it in layperson's terms, but not in a boring way. And then create it into a story that people are learning science, but it's interesting enough that they keep reading. So I had the science piece of it. And then there's this historical context because Wilhelm was born in 1900 and the world changed. Mm-hmm. He didn't have electricity. He didn't have running water growing up. He lived out on the prairie, you know, on a farm in southern Iowa, very poor. And everything was changing during his life. And it was just so interesting building that into the story of how the world was changing as he grew up and describing, you know, a one-room schoolhouse that he started his schooling in. So that life story of him and the time that he grew up in, and just weaving all this together and, you know, the Manhattan Project piece of it. So it was very complex weaving all this together and trying to make it so that I didn't go too long on one part and put in a good family story in there somewhere and a funny story. And there were sad stories, you know, he had two siblings who died in their youth and, you know, all these things, trying to make it so that people could relate to him as a character.
Right.
I don't know. I guess I did a pretty good job. I mean, I had so many self-doubts, and my husband says I'm like a pendulum. I mean, one minute I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. And the next minute I'm like, I'm the biggest loser that ever walked the planet.
Once again, welcome to being a writer. Yeah. Yeah. And every author will tell you the same story from the person who started a month after you did to Stephen King. They'll all say the same thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Those doldrums are real.
Right.
And on the subject of your subject, on the subject of your subject as a character, even though it's a nonfiction book, even though it's a biography in part, in the day job, I help authors and other creative people with their stuff, all of it, all their creative endeavors. And part of that has, over the years, I've served as a developmental editor for some folks who are writing memoir and who are writing biography. And this question always comes up because even though it's a real person with real history, there's still a character arc. You know, it's the arc of their lives. But if you look at a whole life, if we even look at chapters of our own lives, you can find that story structure, to come back to that. It's in there. You just have to have the perspective to see it. How, and you mentioned, you know, in inserting the family stories and the personal tragedies and triumphs and all of that. Was this something that you were conscious of, finding that character arc? Or is it something that you began to see almost as, to use a scientific term, an emergent property of the research and the work?
I went into the project knowing I needed to do that in order for the readers to be engaged and to connect with him. But I didn't know the pieces of it until I discovered them and uncovered them in my research and my interviews. So it fit together as a puzzle as I was gathering more and more information about him and then figuring out, well, what's the layout of the book going to be? I really thought for a long time, well, what is this structure got to be for people to want to know more about Wilhelm, right? So I had to get them engaged in like this work that he did that was so important to the outcome of the war, and then tell them all about who this guy was and where he came from and how it's really quite miraculous that he pulled this off given his background and where he came from. And then just having people feel really good about him at the end. You know, he's winning all kinds of awards, but he takes them home and he puts them in his closet. So he's this humble character that people just like fall in love with.
Still on the structure thing a little bit, because this was your first attempt at a full length book. And so I'm sure people who are just starting out, or even people who haven't attempted nonfiction, but may have written other stuff. I know we talked about sort of your unintentional education in story structure and all of that just by reading, which is how really, honestly, all of us come to it, whether we end up going to school for it or not. It's usually how it first happens. We get that sort of instinct for story. But in the process of this, and you said it was a decade-long research and writing endeavor, did you consult any writing books, take any workshops, anything like that during the course?
That's a great question. So my husband, whatever stage I was working on, he would buy books for me. He would research mm-hmm. books on what are the best books, and he'd give them to me. Sometimes I used them, sometimes I didn't. But I would kind of go back and look through them and kind of just let things sink in a little bit. But I also belong to the Rochester Writers Group here in Rochester. So the early chapters, I had them reviewing and giving me feedback. And it was great. I really took it to heart. I was not afraid of the criticism. I really believed you have to just keep your mouth shut and listen and not right. interrupt and not try and defend your work. Right. And I really did listen to that. And then I rewrote. And I didn't put it in front of a professional editor until I had actually had beta readers read it and give me feedback. And then I did kind of my own proofing, and then finally hired an editor. Actually, I had an agent, and I actually had seven offers from agents for this book. And he was the only one that saw my vision for what the book should be. And so I went with him, and then he got it in front of like 50 publishers. I mean, he did a great job getting in front of publishers, but none of them bought the book. And so he did a good job getting it in front of publishers. And when nobody bought it, I'm like, well, I'm just going to do it myself. I really didn't want to, but I'm going to. And so I decided to make the investment in time and money. And, you know, editor is not cheap, especially my editor. She was very good. Mm-hmm. And I got super lucky. I met her through LinkedIn. She was like the perfect fit. And she's anti-nuclear weapons. And so I thought, oh, if I can write a book that she likes and appreciates, then she's a good editor and she's a good fit for this book, right? Mm-hmm. So I paid for the editor, then a copy editor, then a proofreader, of course, a graphic artist for the cover, ebook formatter, and, you know, incurred a lot of expense.
Sure.
To do this. But I'm like, I think this book is worth it. And for me, it was a family story, but I don't even think of it as a family story. It's history. It's Iowa's history. It's U.S. history. And it's actually world history. And nobody's ever heard of them. And I thought that story needed to get out there. So I just did it. I bit the bullet and spent the money and did it. And I spent the time making it credible, which was really hard because my husband and I have talked about this a lot. I could have published it 3 years earlier. It would have been a better book. And I would have been sure my parents would be alive when it was published, but I risked it by taking the time to get it right and going back and rewriting it and just trying to make it the best book I can with the risk that my parents might not be alive to see it published.
Right.
And that was important because it was his dad.
Sure. So your agent, at the very least, they can stick around and maybe try to get other rights sold. And I commend you for taking the time and spending the resources on, you know, getting the external editor, getting the external cover designer, book designer, and all of that. With self-publishing, it's always a tug of war between, well, the old triangle, right? Do you want it good, fast, or cheap?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. And you can have two, right? That's the cliche. That's the joke. But it might be cheap monetarily, but if you do it yourself, you're going to pay in time.
Yeah.
You know, and not even just the time to watch the YouTube videos to learn how to do this or that, you know, I mean, I'm being, you know, light about that, but, but the point is that you can learn how to do something, but that doesn't give you necessarily the expertise.
Yes.
That, someone else, a professional will have. And, you know, of course, especially with the editing, and you did all phases of the editing, which again is, you know, I'm hammering on this point because again, folks who self-publish often assume that they can get away with good enough, you know, and maybe they can, you know, the audience is always the final arbiter of value. When it comes to this kind of stuff, and there are different these things are measured by different yardsticks, you know.
Yes.
Yep. Which is not a good or bad thing. It's just, you know, it just is. Right. But for something like this, I mean, you spent a decade and you decided to do it in a way that I think respects both the story and the effort that you had already put into it. Again, I just want to point that out mostly for our listeners, you know, to give you a tip of the hat, but also to let people know that, you know, even self-publishing, take the time, do the work, and be prepared to sacrifice. You know, self-publishing means investing in your own work ahead of time and getting to published ultimately faster. But, you know, waiting around for someone else to acknowledge the work and put their money and their time into it as a publisher, well, that's out of your control.
Right. Yep.
Neither one is, you know, intrinsically better than the other, but those are the choices to make. And if you're going to choose self-publishing, well, then, yeah, within one's own scope of resources, do whatever you can to make it as best as possible. So that's
exactly what I wanted. I wanted it to be credible and a good book that kept people turning the page. And I can't believe it's my first book and I won the Minnesota Book Award. I mean, I'm like, I can't believe it.
Well, that segues nicely into the next sort of tentpole of what we talk about here. Talk a little bit about, from your perspective now, from looking forward, however you want to approach this, what is your definition of success for yourself?
Oh, I think it's multi-pronged because I've always been a very goal-oriented person. So, you know, wanted it to be a credible book. Well, then I got a book done and I got pretty good reviews. I'm like, well, maybe I should enter this into the book awards. And then I, you know, win the book award. But for me as a creator, I want to be, you know, well-received by the audience. That to me, ultimately, I want people to read my book. Mm-hmm. That's the ultimate success, is for them to read the book. It's just a bonus to be able to win a book award. I mean, that was not even within the realm of my thinking as I was working on this book. And I never would have gone down that path except of entering it because I was self-published and had to enter it myself. For me also, it's giving me the chance to do more public speaking because I am a public speaker. In my career and business, I was always giving presentations and, you know, motivating people and doing things. And one of the things that I did for this book before it was published, a year before it was published, I started strategically linking to people on LinkedIn who I thought would be interested in the book. And ultimately, I connected to people at the Department of Energy and Iowa State University, and I've been a paid guest speaker at both now with, you know, zeros on it. So for me, that's that for me personally, you know, I wanted to be able to get other revenue streams from my writing. And that was a goal. And so now I'm doing little gigs, historical societies, and I go and I, you know, make a few hundred bucks and I sell some books and but then they tell other people about the book. So I want to, for me, keep the talk going. I mean, a lot of books have a shelf life. I don't want mine to have a shelf life that's 6 months. I want it to keep going and going. And as I write other books, have that just add on to it, right? And keep it going and going.
Yeah, you want it to have, I'm sorry to say this, you want it to have a half-life.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Laughing because of the European, fruit. Right?
Low-hanging fruit. I had to pluck it.
I love it.
But, I like that you, and you know, this is a testament to your marketing background. You knew well ahead of time to start reaching out to people and making relevant connections. And this is something that I advise people as a book coach, as a writing coach, because these days, whether you're self-published or traditionally published, marketing is the writer's job. I'm always telling people, you know, the best time to start talking about your work is like a year before, before you're even done with the damn thing.
Right.
Because you need to build that community. And I call it a community. It's whatever you want to call it, an audience. But they need to start having you on their radar, whether it's participating in other communities online or otherwise that are related to the work, you know, and showing up there as a valued participant, you know, and contributor, or like you've done, you know, reaching out. And I don't think you mentioned it specifically, but did you do any sort of what would amount to a cross media workshopping of the book by using the topic of the book for the subject of talks before the book was published?
I did a few speaking gigs before it was published over the last few years. Yeah.
So some of those events that you did before the book was out, did your experience there in presenting a form of the story, did that inform the actual writing or show you like spots where, oh, you know what, this story, even as I'm presenting it orally, there's a little weak spot here. There's a place I could buff out over here. There's this part that could be fleshed out a little bit more. And did any of that, was there a, I guess what I'm saying is, was there a unexpected benefits to those appearances?
I think that actually what the benefit was a couplefold. The first was that I ended up laying out my book kind of in the same format that I laid out my speeches, which I didn't realize I was doing because I had the talks organized before I had the book organized.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah.
So that's interesting. And then the other thing was that I did some marketing in the way that I was presenting, but I always did a drawing and said, when the book is published, you can win. I'll get you a book. Mm. And so I had a little slip of paper on every sheet and I got everybody's email address. And then when the book came out, I emailed everybody.
Excellent.
And then I also delivered the books that I'd promised. And so lots of people ordered books that had been at my talks in the past.
Perfect. Yes. If you were my client, I'd be saying you did everything right. Thank you very much. Because no, that's so key, is promotion is no good unless you have a way to close that circle.
Right.
You know, if you're going to meet these people, make sure that they have a reason to want to, you know, in quotes, talk to you again, to engage with you again, and that you have permission to do that. And it's never too early to start. And that's what you, absolutely, that's what you did to set that up. And of course, we all, you know, getting the work to the readers and, you know, making sure that people are, you know, hopefully reading the book, all of that. I like to say that a creative work isn't art necessarily until other people have experienced it, you know, other than the person who made the thing. Do you think that the work itself is collaborative in that sense? We always think we know what it is we're writing. You know, we have a goal, we have an outline, we have, you know, all the whole thing. We have a, and then when it gets into the hands of readers, they might share insights and that we didn't recognize, that we didn't realize things that that you did mm-hmm. that are of value, that move people, that inform people in ways that you hadn't anticipated. I guess that's what I mean by it it being an act of creation, but it becomes art when other people experience it. What do you think of that? I'll just leave it at that.
I think that I did not know that it was art until I got feedback mm-hmm. from people who are reading it. Mm-hmm. And the Rochester Writers Group, I mean, those early drafts, they were not art. they were so, you know, remedial compared to what the final product was, mm-hmm. but it was a work in progress and they were contributing to the art by giving me that feedback. Mm-hmm. And, I'm, you know, beyond thrilled that I was able to pull it off.
Yes,
I did not know that I could do that. I did not know that I could do this. I really didn't. And I didn't know what the outcome was going to be when I started. I really was going down a path of with blinders on. And I just kept slowly seeing more and more as I went down the path and got more feedback from people. But it was, really a journey, a huge journey, a life-changing journey.
I think emotionally, psychologically, any kind of long-term, well, let's just say any kind of writing project, maybe any kind of creative project, period, is, no matter how often you've done it, it's performed, it's engaged in the fog of war, if you will. You know? Mm-hmm. There's yes. always something just below, beyond the edge of the headlights that you're not sure of, but you just keep driving.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And this, you know, you've said this was a very long process. You went into it basically completely as a blank slate, other than, you know, knowing the actual stories and hearing the actual stories from your family. So you can approach this this next sort of subject as transparently, as vulnerably, as personally as you're comfortable with, and think of it in terms of both the experience that you've had with this first book and going into now a 5-book project. What have you learned? What did you experience in terms of just keeping it together? Staying healthy and sane in however you want to interpret that through the writing life?
Well, there are times where I just had to like get away from it. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is too much. It's too hard. I can't do this. I need a break. And I set it down and I wouldn't do anything for a month. which is not the way it's going to be going forward, because it's not, I think I'm not as scared now. I had a lot of fear of the unknown, fear of failure, fear that it was going to be a joke. So it's like, and I persevered. I just can't believe I did it. And then to have it actually be really, really, really good is like, I can't believe it. Now I feel like I can do anything.
Do you think that confidence that you're feeling now, that motivation you're feeling now, was that more a result of persevering and finishing the darn thing, or the external validation that you've received since it's been out in the world? Or, you know, what's the ratio?
Yeah, I think that it's that external for me.
Yeah.
Because I am that dog of the bone. When I do something, I'm going to get it done. Mm-hmm. But getting that validation, I don't know, maybe it's vain or something, but I just, that validation has meant a lot to me.
No, I don't think it's vain. I think that's, if we create something and it's not, you know, again, if it's not experienced by others, it's like, well, okay, I made the thing and nobody's really hearing this sound that I've made, you know, nobody's getting this message that I felt it was so important, you know? So absolutely. I don't think it's vanity. I think, and I say this about anyone who has a creative inkling, you know, that if you have the urge to make a thing, you know, to add something to the culture that didn't exist before, it's your responsibility to do it, to go through with it, because that's something that others are going to experience, that, you know, almost with the marketing thing again, you know, they didn't even know they needed to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, you can't, sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, and so as creators, and you know, sometimes people are like, well, you know, I'm not going to write this book or that book because someone else has already written something like that, or, you know, how do I decide? Well, nobody has created the thing that you're going to make, no matter if it's, you know, whatever, another zombie book, fine, make it your zombie book, you know?
Yeah. You
know? So yeah, no, I don't think it's vanity at all. I think it's you have fulfilled your creative responsibility, and you know, you want that circuit to be closed. You want that circle to be closed. You want other people have to, they need to hear the good word.
Right. You know, what's interesting, what you just said about the responsibility, mm-hmm. You know, I have siblings and I have cousins, and nobody else wrote the book. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I took on this responsibility of carrying on this legacy for the family.
Yes.
And even though, like I said, it's really Iowa world and, you know, US history, it's also our family legacy. Right. And I guess maybe I'm the only person that could have done it in the family because of who I am and my nature.
Right.
And, you know, everybody, they all have their own strengths and things that they bring to the world, but that's not it. And actually both my siblings are very creative, mm-hmm. but they are not this kind of creative.
Yes. Right. Yeah, exactly. So no, that's great. You know, put aside that self-talk that it might be vanity, because, well, you know, vanity is a driver as well. And sometimes that's, and I'm not saying this was the case with you, but I'm saying that the, whatever it takes to get the work out, you know, if it's going to be of value to the rest of the world, then yeah, all right. Okay. So it was vanity. So what, you know, I mean, you didn't have to enter that award contest, but you chose to, and it pays off, not just for your own validation, but it means that the book is going to be exposed by still more readers, and
yes,
they're going to learn something. They're going to be inspired. Their lives are going to change in ways large and small. We can't predict, mm-hmm. you know, but mm-hmm. that they would not have had the opportunity to without this particular book. And right. That's the magic of all books, of all narrative media, really, you know?
Yes, definitely.
Wonderful. Well, what else? You mentioned taking breaks, you know, taking a month or so off here and there when it got to be, you know, I'm going to say close to burnout on it. What else can you say about some of your practices, either while you were writing that book or that you anticipate adopting as you leap into this next project?
Well, I think the getting feedback. So I haven't, you know, I'll write a draft and then I'll have my husband read it. I didn't for Wilhelm's Way, but I will for Wilhelm's Way, he was out of the loop. I didn't have him read the book at all until I was ready for a beta reader, but I was getting feedback from the Rochester Writers Group.
Yeah.
With the fiction, I'm going to be probably letting him read it early on, and then I'll probably return and get their input as well.
Is there anything that we haven't touched on or things that we sort of skimmed on that you'd like to go deeper with before we wrap up?
I just feel so blessed right now to be on the path I'm on.
Indeed. I can hear it in your voice. If there was a single one or two sentence bit of wisdom or the bumper sticker slogan for your creative career up to this point, if you had one thing to convey, to express, what would that sort of pithy, ridiculously concise bumper sticker slogan be?
I would say, be patient and be kind to yourself, because it takes time to get it right. And don't beat yourself up. You're going to, but try not to beat yourself up because it's not right the first time. And be patient, because that's just part of the process. And be kind to yourself while you're doing that.
Be kind to yourself. You know, I don't think anyone has mentioned that part yet of the folks that I've talked to. And it's so important, because there are so many places and moments and days and months along the way that, you know, we can be our own worst enemy, you know, especially in that creative phase where maybe nobody else is seeing the work. Maybe nobody, you know, a good portion of writing is staring at the wall, right? Uh-huh. It's all between your ears.
And you know, there's all these people around you that, you know, for a decade, I'm writing a book, and you know, they're going, oh yeah, right, sure, whatever, believe it when I see it, like my dad, you know, having the belief in myself that I was going to get this done was hard sometimes to keep that going. And, you know, my family used to say, she's working on the book, you know, and it's like, yeah, the book, it is a book, and it's a damn good book. But I had to have that belief to keep going, even though the people around, they don't know, because they're not seeing it. It's effort. And it's, people think writing is, in fact, you know, now that I've written a book, everybody's, oh, I want to write a book. I've always wanted to write a book. And I just think, yep, you can do it, but you probably won't.
Bitch, please, right?
And to write a book like I wrote, you really won't do it.
Most people will not. You're right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something just now that I am not going to be able to remember who said it. So it's going to be not just a paraphrase, but an unattributed paraphrase.
Okay.
But what I'll end up doing after the fact is for the show notes, I will find the source if I can. But I suspect that more than one creator and author has said this. But basically, the point is that we have to be a little delusional to just maintain the unfounded, you know, and unproven confidence that what we're doing is worth doing,
you right.
know, because we've only got ourselves to say, yes, keep going, because you will have those naysayers, even if they don't mean it intentionally. They are there with their chisels, chipping away at the bridge, at the foundation, at the ground you're standing on creatively. And it's a fragile path, but yes, be kind to yourself and be patient. I think wonderful advice.
So incredibly lucky to have the husband that I have, because he never doubted it.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. And I mean, it's come across as you've been saying all of that you've been saying, that he has clearly been a steadfast supporter and cheerleader and has probably made uncounted and impossible to measure sacrifices along the way. That's just how it is when when one person is involved in embarking on this very, very difficult and very often years long endeavor. So yes, props to him.
For years, this book was my passion and his second partner. And you know, he was just incredibly willing to listen to every tear and every cry and every idea and every stupid idea, and you know, just right there with me, never once criticized. And I'm just incredibly lucky to have him as my partner.
So wonderful. Well, Teresa Wilhelm Waldoff, thank you so much for this. It's been a lot of fun. And I think there's been a lot that folks will both be inspired by and also be able to take away practically into their own practice. So it's been great.
Thank you so much, Matthew. Truly appreciate it.
Hey there. If you've enjoyed this or any other episode of Sonitotum, here are three things you can do to help support the show. The first thing, if you haven't already, please subscribe for free to Sonitotum with Matthew Wayne Selznick wherever you get your podcasts. Whichever app or platform you use, find that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Second thing, please just take a moment to rate and review Sonitotum. Again, wherever you get your podcasts. Rating is quick and easy. 5 stars is very nice. Go ahead and give the show whatever you think the show deserves. If you have just a few minutes more, please let the world know why you enjoy the show, why other people should listen to it and subscribe, by writing a brief review in your own words. Subscribing, rating, and reviewing, that all costs you nothing but time, but they make a big difference for the show, because when people are looking for podcasts on the writing and creative life, Sonitotum is more likely to show up in search results if it has a high rating and some nice reviews. Finally, Sonitotum with Matthew Wayne Selznick is made available for free and has no advertising, but it does cost time, resources, and money to produce every single week. If you'd like to go the extra mile and you have the will and the means, I hope you'll consider becoming a patron to offset the cost associated with the show and my other creative endeavors. Not only will you be a member of the Multiversalists community of writers, readers, and creators, you'll receive special access, perks, and exclusive content, the least of which is the uncut, unproduced edition of every episode of Sonitotum. Also, get this, your first 7 days are free. After that free trial, it's just $5 per month. Visit mattselznick.com/b-a-patron to find out more and to start your free trial. That's it. If you do one or two or all three of those things, you'll really be helping the show, and more people like you will discover the Sonitotum mission of helping writers and other creators make stuff, find success, and stay healthy and sane in the process. Thank you. Well, there you have it, my friends. Wasn't that a great talk with Teresa Wilhelm Waldoff? You know, I talked to her back in May, and I didn't, you know, quite remember all of the nuances of our conversation. But boy, it was a good one. There was a lot of wisdom there. You know, brand new writer, but not brand new to the world, not brand new to experiences and to various kinds of creativity. And I hope that you really got something out of that. If you did, as always, as I mentioned earlier, before the interview, and as you just heard in the interstitial, I hope you will consider rating and reviewing this episode. I also hope you'll consider leaving your feedback about this episode. As I mentioned, you can go to mattselznick.com/sonitotum-091 and leave a comment in the show notes for this episode, episode 91. You can also simply email me at matt@mattselznick.com, or you can record a little voice message, perhaps on your phone, and email that to matt@mattselznick.com. One way or another, I will respond to your feedback, whether it's replying to your comment there at the website or replying to your email. If you leave a voice message for me, I will include it in a future episode and reply in the episode. And of course, if you have anything you want to refer directly to Teresa Wilhelm Waldorf, you can get that to me in, either by the email, matt@mattselznick.com, or in the comments, and I'll make sure Teresa's aware of it. And here's what you have to say one way or the other. In 2 weeks, we're going to be talking to the horror writer and speculative poet, Darius Jones. And Darius and I met at the Nebula Conference back in May. And then I had a conversation a few weeks later. And it was fun. It was a good time. And that's coming up. I want to thank you for sticking around, especially now that we are on a 2-week schedule. And especially during this period where I'm not going to lie, I'm struggling to keep up with anything that isn't work or family related right now. And this podcast is, while I like to believe that it's a valuable thing for you, it's difficult to squeeze in, even with the 2 weeks between the episodes. But I'm doing it, I'm showing up for you, and I hope you're getting something out of it. Stay subscribed, please. Tell your friends about Sonatotum. Help me grow this show. Help enlarge the reach of people like Teresa Wilhelm Waldorf and my past guests, Deborah Parmley, Celia Lake, Krista Walsh, Jeffrey Doherty, Anthony Eichenlaub, Monica Cross, Rhiannon Held, Joyce Reynolds Ward, P.A. Cornell, and way back when, Emma Wallace, and my future guests, of course, as well. The more people that hear this show, the more people get to hear their voices, and hopefully the more writers and other creators are enriched by that experience. So stick around. Thank you for sticking around. And of course, thank you to my multiversalist patrons who continue to provide stalwart monthly support of at least $5 a month. Chuck Anderson, Amy Bowen, J.C. Hutchins, and Ted Leonhardt. Thank you so much, folks. And if you would like to join the ranks of the multiversalists, you know what to do. Go to mattselznick.com/b-a-patron. All right. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.